If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Thursday afternoon. Coming up a little bit later in the program, did you see the CEO from Chipotle? He was on the Today Show earlier saying he's sorry about all of the problems they've had, people being sickened on the West Coast and on the East Coast in Boston. And we will talk to a Washington Post reporter, Robert Ferdman, about that. You know, part of the issue is that Chipotle works very well at getting locally sourced non-GMO food and all of that. They've really worked toward fresh food, and they've grown so fast that maybe that's starting to catch up with them. So we will catch up with Robert Ferdman a little bit later in the program. Bill Geiger will be here, as he is every Thursday, to talk about your retirement plans. And then Ian Scher from CNET as well will kick around the idea of the pressure that Facebook and Twitter are facing to help look for what might be suspicious posts when it comes to terrorism. That's Ian Scher from CNET. But first, when I grow up, I want to be Gary Mills, which is difficult because Gary Mills is already younger than me. But he is the co-founder of a Pinnacle Performance Company and the author of a book called The Pin Drop Principle. And even more fun for me, a friend of mine for about 25 years now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. So you're a friend, but you would be here anyway. Because I'm interested in the idea, and we've talked back and forth for years about the value of communication, and especially when it comes to listening. People just don't listen so well. Tell me a little bit first about your company, Pinnacle Performance Company. Started as an actor, took those skills, and now you travel the world.
Yeah, I co-founded the company about 10 years ago with a friend of mine named David Lewis. He's also the co-author of our book, The Pin Drop Principle. We were both professional actors. We worked as professional actors for many years, and it was about 10 years ago that David approached me. He had worked on Wall Street, worked in Silicon Valley, and he'd hired a lot of training companies to come in and work with his people, and they were all okay, but not great.
Right.
And they were missing a very vital link. And so he said, do you think we could utilize all these things that we know as an actor to be more engaging, more confident, more persuasive with our communication? Do you think we could use these and bring these into the corporate environment? Could you build a curriculum? And I said, I don't know. Let's try it out. And so we put together a curriculum. We tried it out with some Fortune 500 clients. And one thing led to another, and everybody loved it. We're now in 40 countries around the world training.
Been to Russia, you've been to Saudi
Arabia.
Yeah,
this year, we used to try to add one new country every year to our roster, and now we add like four or five.
Okay, what does a company in Russia benefit from a U.S. instructor on communication?
So communication doesn't matter where you are in the world, it's all about the same thing, right? You've got to get your message across, you've got to be persuasive, you've got to be clear. So it's really just working with them on the same thing. Right now we work in five languages, so we train in five languages. Russian is not one of them. So when I was speaking in Russian, I was brought over to do a keynote from Pin Drop Principle, mm-hmm. So that's what that trip was about.
Which is interesting though, because you're speaking of communication through a translator.
These folks all spoke English.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, these folks all spoke English.
And it is sort of a universal experience communication.
It is, really.
But there must be individual, you know, quirks and perks when you get into one country or another.
Yeah, there are definitely cultural differences. For instance, in Saudi Arabia this year, it was my first time delivering a keynote there. And the Q&A was very interesting, right? Because the women in the audience were all in a separate section, and they were all wearing, you know, the complete cultural garb.
Sure.
from Saudi Arabia. And so it was very challenging to communicate with them when all you see is eyes, right? Even though they're trying to get their message across. And I was actually surprised at how clear the ones who had what we call an intention, a strong intention, how good they were and how clear they were with their message, even when all you could really see flesh-wise was eyes.
All right, let's leave Saudi Arabia and come to the offices here in Chicago and around the country. You said intention and objective.
Yes.
Those are two of the things that you talk about quite a bit.
Yeah, so our company is founded on this idea that the ability to communicate with purpose and clarity is the key to personal and professional success. So whether you're running a meeting, whether you're meeting your in-laws, whether you're presenting ideas, whether you're talking one-on-one to your team member, you have to be able to communicate well if you want to get what you want. And your objective is what you want. Everybody has a goal with communication, right? You have to identify that first, and then your intention is what you pair it with. That's how you're going to get it. Mm-hmm. And it's usually a one-word verb. So it could be, I want to challenge my team. It could be, I want to motivate my client. It could be, I want to reassure the people who go to Chipotle and enjoy our food that we're solving this problem and we're going to make it safe so that they can enjoy their Chipotle food.
A lot of times when people prepare a speech or try to communicate, they think about how they're going to present their message. They don't always think about how their audience is going to receive their message.
Yeah, so we preach a three-step process for communication. And the first step in that process, analyze your audience. Who are you talking about? Who are you talking to? How do they feel about your message? What do they know? What do they not know? What are they looking for?
Right.
Second step, you got to understand how you want them to feel, what you want them to do after hearing your message. And then the third step, modify your delivery.
Now, so I'm sitting here talking to you, and because I like talking to you about listening. And I'm very self-conscious of the fact that as you're talking, I'm looking down at notes, I'm looking to my left at the clock, and I'm trying
multitasking.
To
multitasking.
I am, but I'm not really actively listening like I should. And that's where, so we've talked a little bit about presenting, but when it comes to receiving communication, you need to be in tune to sort of understand what you're hearing too.
Yes, we teach active listening. A couple of things to be better listeners. Focus on the main idea. Focus on the speaker. Don't multitask if at all possible.
Got a text.
Exactly.
Okay, go ahead.
There are 11 million meetings that go on every day in the U.S. So people have a lot of meetings. 61.5 meetings every single month for someone in the corporate environment.
Is that right?
That's a lot of meetings, right?
It's a lot of listening.
So they're a lot of times at those meetings physically, but on their phone, checking email, sending messages on Facebook. So they're not completely there. They're not completely listening.
One more thing, the idea that I remember we talked once before, and there was a survey that looked at how people received information. When there were mixed signals, 55% sort of relied on what they saw, right? What they were seeing as they were hearing the words.
Right.
A third about really relied just on what they heard. And then the 7% was just on the actual words.
Yeah, this was a famous study by Albert Mehrabian in California that talked about congruency and incongruency in communication. He found there are three channels that people use to make judgments about someone else, about their communication, about them as a person, about their product. And those are verbal, vocal, visual. So verbal is the words you are saying. Vocal is how you sound, how you use your voice. And then visual is how you look. What he found in the study was if all three of those channels are congruent, telling the same story, meaning the intention was clear with all three, they're all equally important. But if there's ever incongruence, meaning mixed messages, so I'm saying one thing. But
Rahm Emanuel, I'll give you a perfect example yesterday. We're running late here, but yep. Rahm Emanuel gave a speech yesterday, a very important speech. You could tell he was nervous.
Yep.
He ended with a lot of uptalk. He did not use his voice well. So I would imagine that's where that integration was a little out of whack.
Yeah, so if there's mixed messages, like the example you just gave, then an audience will go 55% to the visual. What are they seeing? They'll go 38% to how you sound and only 7% to your words, right? So 93% will be on the delivery of your message if there's mixed messages.
Before they ever hear the words that
exactly.
You're using.
So if I were to say to you, Steve, I'm not angry.
Right.
Right. If you break that down using Mehrabian's three channels, the delivery is saying I'm angry. The words are saying I'm not angry.
Name of the company is Pinnacle Performance Company. And I know you work with a lot of people around the world, but the people around here, how do they get a hold of you?
www.pinper.com. We do workshops. We do virtual coaching on our new tool. We can work with anybody at any time, anywhere.
Gary, it's always too short. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That's Gary Mills. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Bill Geiger of Geiger Wealth Management is in the studio. Bill, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Steve.
And we were just talking about your retreats, frequent retreats to Florida. And we have a little Florida weather with us this week, so you should be okay.
Yeah, it is just tuning up for my flight down south.
You know, so here it is. We're coming toward the end of the year. People are thinking taxes, and they're probably looking at 401k and all of that. And even though retirement isn't a direct sort of duty at year's end, people are more financially focused. So when is it that, you know, we should kind of, not time of year, but I guess, but age, when should we start looking at our retirement?
If you're in your late 50s to early 60s, that's a great time to really start getting serious about retirement planning.
Okay, so the idea then, if and we've talked before about having a number or things like that, how do you figure out what you need per month coming in order to retire?
Well, one of the things you look at is what is my lifestyle cost right now? And most people don't want to take a step down during retirement. So what are you spending right now? And then figure out what's going to be coming in from Social Security and so on. And the first challenge of preparing for retirement and putting a plan together is how do you fill that gap between what's coming in and what you need? Your bills come in every month, and your income should too. And that's the first challenge of preparing a retirement plan.
I suppose that, I mean, it will be cheaper to retire than it will be to keep working, right?
No, it's not. I mean, that's a conventional wisdom.
Well, I'm not buying the same clothes or commuting. Or
yeah, but you know what you're doing? You're traveling.
Yeah, I hope so.
You're traveling, and the jet fare and the travel and the hotels cost a heck of a lot more than the extra tie you don't have to buy.
So you should figure, you think, on sort of trying to keep your income steady.
Right, you should.
We were talking earlier this week, I think it was maybe with Terry Savage, about the inflation. Inflation's been low, and Social Security representatives or recipients aren't getting a COLA increase this year. But even if that doesn't happen, the costs and expenses they're facing tend to go up.
Yeah, they do. And the official numbers are a heck of a lot lower in terms of inflation than what they feel like. You know, when you're retired, you're going to spend 20, 30, 35 years in retirement. And it's kind of like being unemployed for 20, 30, 35 years. There's no check,
right,
paycheck coming in.
Right. And so
that's the second major challenge of preparing for retirement in your plan. How do you stay up with inflation over that long a time period?
And do what? Just figure out what we're going to be at 2%, we're going to be at 3%, or how do you calculate that?
The long-term average of inflation is around 3%. Even though it's a little bit lower now, we, in our financial planning with our clients, use a 3% number.
Okay, so we've got the idea of what we need to have each month. We're going to factor in inflation and all of that. What's the next step for us?
Well, the third challenge is how do you get the income you need each month, stay up with inflation, and not run out of money, making your money last.
So we're not running out of money, something we should avoid.
Well, I kind of sort of think so.
Yeah.
You know,
the point of it all, isn't
it? And it's the first two. You know, how much income do you need on a monthly basis, and staying up with inflation? It's how you handle those and how you plan for those that goes a really long way toward making your money last. In other words, not running out.
And so what do we do?
Well, you need a financial plan.
Yeah.
You need to understand. You need to sit down and think about and have someone help you plan for how you're going to do those three things. It's not enough just to wait until you're 65 and say, well, I want as big a number as, you know, once in a while I ask somebody to come into the office, you know, what is your plan, what's your retirement plan right now? And sometimes I'll get this blank look, and they'll say, I don't know, I just hope this sucker, referring to their portfolio, is bigger. And that's not a plan, that's
hope. You know, I think that's going to be a big thing for this country, because for so many generations, retirement was sort of not automatic, but it was taken care of for you. You know, you didn't have to make the decisions.
It used to be easy.
Yeah, it used to be you did what you did and it just happened.
Yeah, you had a pension and you had CDs. And that's how you lived.
It's not the way it works anymore.
It doesn't work that way anymore.
I should have asked you before, but I know you have a weekly retirement blog. How do people get a hold of that?
They can very easily go to growmyretirement.com. That's growmyretirement.com. Sign up, and we'll send it out to you every week.
All right, Bill Geiger, if I don't see you, have a great holiday season.
Merry Christmas to you, sir.
Merry Christmas. Remember, you can sign up for Bill. Well, here we go. Bill's weekly retirement planning blog at did you know this address? Growmyretirement.com.
I do.
I figured you might. Geiger Wealth is offering a tremendous opportunity for WGN listeners today. Bill and Geiger Wealth will sit down with you personally to create a full-blown financial plan for your retirement. It's a $3,000 value. Geiger Wealth is offering this at no charge to the next five callers who have at least $500,000 saved for their retirement. Just call Geiger Wealth at 800-681-2498. That's 800-681-2498. Geiger Wealth will translate the complex financial planning process into easy-to-understand steps. It's a full-blown financial plan, analyzing not only where you are today, but most importantly, a roadmap to get you where you need to be. So for the next five callers with at least $500,000 saved for retirement, Geiger Wealth is offering a complimentary financial plan. Give them a call, 800-681-2498. That's 800-681-2498. Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Ian Scherer writes for CNET.com and joins us most Thursdays anyway. This Thursday, no exception. Ian, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, you know, and it's interesting that you wrote a story just yesterday, I think it was, about Mark Zuckerberg and a shout-out or an announcement of support for Muslims around the world when it comes to Facebook, because one of the things I've been looking forward to talking to you about today is this sort of growing pressure on Facebook and Twitter and such to do more when it comes to the fight against terrorism or sort of the surveillance. But let's just start with Zuckerberg's message. What is it that he said, and why do you think he said it?
Well, what he said was that basically if you're a Muslim in the world, that as the leader of Facebook, he wants you to know that you're welcome on his platform and you're welcome to kind of benefit from the free speech that Facebook stands for. Now, there's obviously rules that Facebook has against things like, you know, hate speech and terroristic threats and all of that. And that's not really what he was getting at. What he was really pushing for is this idea that he actually talked about how after Paris and after a lot of the kind of terrorist acts that have happened over the last few weeks, that there's been a lot of what he called hate spreading around the internet. And so he wanted to kind of step back from that and say, look, you know, I don't want a whole group of people not to feel comfortable using Facebook.
So this
so that's why he made the statement he did.
So this was sort of a response more to Donald Trump than, say, Dianne Feinstein, who's introducing legislation in Washington.
Well, I think you could read into it that way. He never said the word Trump, so I don't want to put words in his mouth. But, you know, he said that he really wants to make sure that he creates a safe environment for these people. In terms of the rest of the government, there is increasing pressure on Facebook, Twitter, everybody, Apple, to start getting involved in the fight against global terrorism by doing stuff like weakening encryption things that are supposed to keep our information safe, and all sorts of stuff like that, because the government feels like technology has kind of run amok and that now it is much easier than ever for terrorists and people who want to do bad things to communicate without ever being worrying about the government snooping on them.
So Feinstein introduced this piece of legislation this week, would require social media companies like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube to alert law enforcement when they come across terror activities on their platform. Now,
right.
And that seems to be sort of a softball, right? It doesn't require them to look for it, but if they come upon something, they're required to, I don't know, maybe that is stronger than I think, notify law enforcement.
It's actually something that a lot of the companies already do. This is not a new thing. And Feinstein, as you said, is more of a softball, where you're really seeing pressure is, like, for example, when President Obama got on national television on Sunday and said that he's going to start pressuring the Silicon Valley to get involved in the fight on global terrorism.
Tell me
and
about
you hear Hillary Clinton saying that, you know, we need to change the way technology works to fight. And those are much more strong opinions than what Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, is trying to introduce.
So when she says change technology, is she talking about encryption?
Well, she left it open-ended, right? But you see stuff like the FBI, who had said that they were going to back off on this debate, actually renewing calls for encryption to change. You see that a lot of these, this thing is coming up again and again. Let's talk about Europe for a second. If you go to Britain, you go to France, you start seeing lawmakers who are saying they want to outlaw encryption. And so there's a lot of pressure on the technology industry right now as kind of a center of the debate around how terrorists communicate on in the modern world.
Ian,
and that's what's really fascinating.
Bat, let's back up a little bit. Tell me what encryption is and why it's important.
Sure.
And why it could be tough when it comes to fighting terrorism.
Well, so basically encryption is when you take information and you jumble it up with an algorithm, a computer code. And what it is that it's meant so that only the intended recipient can read it. So until encryption came along, I could send you a text message or I could send you an email. And pretty much anyone who was able to see it as it traveled across the internet would be able to read it. That included the NSA, the FBI, CIA, whoever might want to try and tap into it, which is why you heard about what Edward Snowden talked about a few years ago with what the government was able to do. A lot of that was because of a lack of encryption. So in response, Silicon Valley has basically enacted a ton of encryption rules on all their hardware and all of their services. And so now, for example, Apple's iMessage, which is a free text messaging service they offer for all iPhone users, it's encrypted. If I send you a message, no one can read it except for you, including Apple. And so that is where the government is really starting to get concerned, is that if it's that way, then what's to stop a terrorist group from being able to communicate? And they say that they've been able to stop a lot of attacks or at least slow down their movements because they're able to listen in and read in on what they're talking about.
Does that encryption help me, like if I'm sending you my credit card number, or am I protected with something short of encryption?
Yeah, so it definitely does protect us in normal people in general day-to-day life, right? It, for example, when I went to visit the White House a few years ago, I had to send them my Social Security number over email.
Right.
And I felt really uncomfortable about that. I'm like, can't I call? They're like, no, we don't have the time. And so, you know, it's that type of thing where there are a lot of times that we naturally, as normal people, pass along information to each other that you don't want a hacker to get. And as we have learned many times now, hackers are picking up stuff all over the place and creating these massive profiles of who you and I are so they can more easily hack us. So the less information is readable by someone other than you, the better. And so that's why encryption has also become very popular just as a technology generally, even if you ignore what Edward Snowden talked about with the NSA.
All right, but no one wants terror attacks, and everyone wants to find a way to stop that. And there's great pressure to do that now. Will we see a change at Microsoft, at Apple, and elsewhere? Will we see sort of a scaling back of this encryption?
That's the existential question of the day. And I honestly don't know the answer for you. I know that a lot of these companies are really coming out and very rare do you hear Silicon Valley get this political. But you see people like Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, coming out and saying it's a bad idea. You hear other companies coming out and saying, if we create a backdoor so the government can listen in when they think that there's a terrorist, what's to stop hackers from using that exact same backdoor? And so there's a lot of very strong political comments coming out of Silicon Valley saying, this is a bad idea, we cannot do it this way. And so even if it's technologically feasible, they don't want to go down that road. At the moment, there's no way to be able to hack a lot of the encryption on our devices. So the government's worried no matter what. But Silicon Valley is not willing to go that step yet.
That's a big story, and one that I know we'll hear more about. Of course, another one is Marissa, is it Meyer or Mayer?
Mayer.
Marissa Mayer tweeted out today that she's had her twins. So
yes.
The two-week maternity leave is underway.
Yes, and that's also a fascinating thing, right? We're writing about this on CNET, but the whole idea of how family leave is being handled across Silicon Valley is really fascinating, right? You have there's almost been a one-upmanship among many of the tech companies these days about who is going to offer the most family services,
and
of course, it makes sense. A lot of the people are younger and all of that, and so Marissa Mayer, on the other end of it, Yahoo offers a maternity leave policy, but she's only taking 2 weeks. Because she says, Yahoo needs too much work, I can't be away for that long. And so even though Yahoo offers all this time, what's really fascinating and part of the debate is this idea that, okay, well, what is that signal to all the workers, right? Even if you offer 2 or 3 months off and paid for the family, if the CEO is only taking 2 weeks, what expectation is that setting?
Ian,
that's
gonna,
a lot of the debate.
Yeah, I know, and it's going to keep going. I'm going to Stop the conversation now so that you can run out and buy your baby Bjorns for the mayors. Okay? Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Thank you, Orion, Kim, and Dolly. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Thursday afternoon. All right, so maybe you saw on the Today Show the CEO of Chipotle was talking there, and he issued an apology. He said, I'm sorry. You know, a lot of people have been sick. Dozens of stores. Chipotle's closed in the Pacific Northwest and elsewhere. Now more than 100 students sickened at BC. And, well, it's something that that earlier this week Roberto Ferdman had written about in the Washington Post, and he joins us now to talk about sort of the dilemma that Chipotle is in. And it's not just your typical sort of food and salmonella problem, is it, Roberto?
It's not. I mean, as of today, they've not just had problems with E. coli, which was the main outbreak that we've seen in 8 states around the country, but at BC it was a problem with norovirus, which people might know as stomach virus or as food poisoning. And the issue, which the Boston Health Department pointed out, might have been caused by a few health violations that happened at the store. So really what we're talking about are problems with the way in which Chipotle oversees the handling of its food and the making sure that they adhere to various food safety protocols.
And so in Boston, it sounds like, and unless there's something new, it sounds like there was someone who worked there who went to work sick and then passed that illness into the people through a food that he or she touched. Is that a correct assessment?
That's probably what happened, although another violation cited the fact that they were handling chicken that wasn't hot enough, which might have allowed them to spread the neurovirus. But yeah, what's likely is that this person was sick and was allowed to come into work.
And with the earlier case, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say that's a problem at a lot of places, not just restaurant establishments.
Right.
There's been a lot of push to stop sick people from coming to work because they get others sick.
And there are other restaurants that have trouble with salmonella too, but where Chipotle is in sort of a unique situation is that they very much market the freshness of their food, the local origination of their food, the no antibiotic and all of that of their food, which I think is a great thing. And I don't want to see them suffer for that. But I've been reading in some spots that because of that, it makes them harder to sort of guarantee the safety of their food. Now, is that true?
Well, Chipotle itself acknowledged that point earlier this year in its most recent annual report. They said the fact that they use fresh food and that they don't use automated cooking methods, they have workers working at the grill making their food, might make them more prone to food illnesses and food illness outbreaks like the one that we saw. The reason that is mostly tied to the latter part and the combination of the two. But if you have people working at the counter, they might not use gloves one time, the food might carry some sort of pathogen, and then they're transferring pathogens from chicken to produce, and then the produce is being served to people. So in some ways, yes, that is true, although with the right safety protocols, it shouldn't be an issue, which is something that food safety experts told me and that Chipotle has acknowledged in the aftermath of this problem.
Well, they're very successful, and they've been growing very quickly, and I know that puts a strain on their supply of food, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the problem that Chipotle is facing is that it's not very easy to scale and especially quickly scale a company like theirs. You're right to point out their mission to serve food with integrity. That's been an issue for them recently. In fact, earlier this year when they had to stop serving pork because their main supplier wasn't meeting their standards, the result was a hit on their business for 2 quarters. They reported disappointing earnings because people actually wanted pork in their stores, but they weren't willing to provide it because they wanted to continue to meet their standards. And now we're seeing that they're going to implement new food safety measures, which will require that all of their suppliers test foods before they arrive. And there's a suspicion that some suppliers, especially those that provide poultry, because the chicken industry hasn't historically tested all of the chicken that they supply to the industry, might push back. That could mean, although I don't know, and it may very well not, but it could mean that chicken is the sort of chicken that, they find acceptable, especially in the aftermath of this problem, is harder to come by than, they would expect or that their customers would like.
Well, my worry is, I mean, this is a great movement, moving toward fresher food, and but, you know, my worry is that this might spread beyond Chipotle and actually impact other restaurants that are doing this, that there might be some backlash. So we'll just have to see if that's what happens. Roberta Ferdman from The Washington Post, thanks very much for helping us out today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
You bet. Hope we can talk again. Bill and Wendy right around the corner here on 720 WGN.